Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm David Jenkins.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And today we'll be talking about Prano Bailey Bond's video nasty era horror Censor and Nick Cage tracking down a truffle hunter in Pig. We'll also hear from Alex Wolff about working on Pig with Nick Cage. And in Film Club, we're going back to one of the original video nasties, 1981's Possession. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. David, Hannah, welcome back to Truth and Movies. Always a pleasure. David, what's the latest at Little White Lies Towers? Are we any closer to hearing about that new issue?
We're so close. We're so close, but not quite yet. We have to. We're keeping it in the oven, just for that little extra 5 minutes to make sure it's done on the inside, and the knife's coming out clean. Yeah, it's been a fun one to do. It's a really big one. It's our 90th issue. Massive effort from a lot of people involved in this one, and it's a bit like the cover film. It's a bit of an epic. So can't wait for people to see it, and hopefully people will be excited by it. It's a good one, I think.
It's almost like one of those wanna feel old memes where I remember the 50th issue.
Yeah.
Gosh, life comes at you fast. But thank you for kicking off the speculation there with a hint about what the cover issue may be. Hannah, what's going on in your world? Any big news for you?
Oh, you know, just a small announcement made last week. So I finally, after after months of saying I'm writing a book, I have been able to announce what the book is about. So it's the latest in our Little White Lies X Abrams New York. I don't know how you would... our collaboration with the publisher Abrams New York, and it is a monograph on Sofia Coppola called Sofia Coppola Forever Young, which I'm going to have to get used to saying, even though it just makes me want to sing the iconic disco kind of... No, it's more like a ballad,
Kind of new romantic thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Does it feature in any of her films?
No.
That's good. I think that's a good thing because the vibe does.
Yeah, the vibe definitely does. It is funny because we chose that title and afterwards I kind of convinced myself it wasn't one of her films. It's definitely not. It's very exciting. That is out in May next year and I'm sure we'll talk about it lots more on the podcast in future. Very exciting news.
I can't wait to hear more, see more and read it when it finally comes out, Hannah. That's such exciting news. But we've got a bumper episode this week, two new releases of Film Club as always, but a special interview as well. So we should kick things off with our first new release of the week with Censor. A bit of plot synopsis for Censor up top. Britain, 1985. When film censor Enid, played by Neve Algar, discovers an eerie horror that speaks directly to her sister's mysterious disappearance, she resolves to unravel the puzzle behind the film and its enigmatic director, a quest that will blur the lines between fiction and reality in terrifying ways. So David, I'll come to you first on this review. This has been positioned as a riff on the video nasty era. Of course, it's set in 1985 at a time where horror films are being scrutinised and... and banned or heavily cut. That's what the central character is about. But what sort of riff is this? It's not like it's making a gore-filled 80s horror, or is it?
Well, that's an interesting one. It's I think that question is probably what makes this film so interesting for me, because it sort of eludes easy categorization. And I think because it is set in this world of the video nasty, and it's a kind of very vivid, smoke-filled, fuggy kind of 1980s, but not too kind of like, you know, without putting too fine a point on it, a very sort of subtle evocation of the 1980s. And yet it exists in this world of video nasties and the Video Recordings Act, in which a lot of horror films were banned for being kind of like morally outrageous and contributing to kind of hysteria and violence and copycat crimes, and, you know, none of which were ever proven or you know, given any kind of credence to. So it was a real kind of like, you know, one of the big kind of like blemishes on our kind of cultural history, I think. And the film focuses on this character Enid, who is a censor, who does this job of watching films in this disconnected, objective way, and applying to them the sort of rigors of censorship and cutting and taking bits out and making them palatable for people. And I guess like it initially suggests that it is about the kind of toil of that job and the sort of psychological toil of actually seeing all these kind of graphic images as a, you know, as the sort of last bastion of between, or kind of like, you know, the sort of sitting between the you know, the last guard between the public and these films. So but then you're in this world and you kind of think, oh, it's got to be a horror film because it's about horror films, and you're seeing these kind of remade clips of these video nasties and really sort of scrungy exploitation films, and but it kind of turns out to be something a bit different, really. And it's more it almost feels like a melodrama. Without, I don't really want to say any more without giving it away, but it's kind of like a sort of historical melodrama that's more about a kind of character being kind of triggered by memories and going off and searching for some kind of elusive truth in her own life. And it's a really kind of, it kind of wrong foots you in a really interesting and pleasing way, I think.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to box it in because this is a new rising filmmaker, but I think its evocation of the era or sort of adjacency to the horror genre is similar to something like Peter Strickland's films, like The Barbarian Sound Studio. He doesn't create a giallo film in that film, but it is seeped with a clear love of the genre. As I said, this is Prana Bailey Bond's debut. She's been around for a few years, making some great shorts on the horror circuit here in the UK. But it's always interesting to get a new perspective on the horror genre, particularly the 80s as well. Hannah, what did you make of Censor?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to watch it at Sundance back in January, the sort of all virtual edition, which was, I have to say, incredibly well organised and run. Of all the virtual festivals I've done, it's definitely been the kind of the highlight. They really smashed it in terms of organisation and programming. And I was really excited for it, being a kind of fan of the video nasties genre, subgenre. And that general, I find that general era so interesting, the whole kind of Mary Whitehouse ban this filth era, because it's a little bit before my time, but definitely the ramifications, I think, lasted kind of throughout my childhood. And my parents were quite strict about the types of films I watched, so I don't think I saw any even like light horror films until I was probably about 16. So it was a real sort of intriguing one that I saw had popped up in the programme. And then when I sat down and watched it, even in the comfort of my own home, I was very kind of taken with it. I thought it was very kind of unexpected I think I maybe had this preconceived notion that it was going to be like lean more heavily into the video nasty kind of like mold, I guess. But actually, it is more of its own kind of thing. It is subverting the kind of idea of these poor innocent women being kind of like, you know, set upon in very ugly ways, which I discovered more of as we kind of, in our last issue, the first Cow issue of Little White Lies, we kind of did a deep dive into the video nasties, and I got to have watched some really terrible films as a result of that. And it was, it kind of made my affection for Sensor grow even more, because I thought it's so nice to think we've come such a long way in a relatively short span of time, you know, about, what is it now, 30, 40 years, and horror has kind of completely changed, but there's still a sort of reverence for these kind of four fathers and four mothers, particularly the actresses who kind of gave so much of themselves to oftentimes kind of go unremembered. And, you know, we only ever talk about the kind of the big names, the Jamie Lee Curtis of the world, but, you know, you go back and look and there's this whole world of kind of women who were screaming their lungs out and getting covered in red paint. And it's, you know, I think it is, for anyone who kind of likes horror, is really essential viewing. And I just had such a fun time with Sensor. It's one of the few films that I've actually like made the effort to go and watch in a cinema. So it was originally meant to come out a few months ago, but then, you know, COVID schedules, so it got pushed back to now. But I went to a screening and I was so kind of glad I did, because seeing it on the big screen, you know, kind of getting lost in the incredible sort of soundscape of this movie, it's really like, you feel like you're in that little underground rabbit warren that is the censor board. I can't say the BBFC because it's not the BBFC, with Enid. And I just, I really think it blurs the kind of lines between drama, horror, a little bit of comedy. Michael Smiley pops up in this
in the funniest house ever.
A producer for these video nasties, and very slimy sort of guy, and he has the best house I maybe have seen all year. Rivals the Parasite house for me in terms of like iconic cinema houses. I don't know if David wants to talk about that house a little bit.
I did love that house when it just crops up. I just love, I mean, it has this kind of, I think one of the things I really liked about the film is that although it is set in this world that could potentially be very referential and very insidery, I love the fact that Bailey Bond has basically taken the effort to actually build her own world inspired by it. So there's probably some references to that. Yeah, there's probably many references to things in there that you're going to get, but you don't necessarily need to have seen any of these films to kind of understand what she's doing and the world that she's existing in. Like, you know, the idea of like, it's just very, very funny idea of like the parochialism of these video nasty directors. Like, you know, by day they're living in these like kind of like, you know, weird cottages, weird suburban cottages, and then by night they're out in the woods with fake blood and kind of realizing that these really kind of gruesome fantasies. So like, there is this kind of like de-romanticization of like movie making in the film as being quite kind of, you know, quite sort of squalid and not, you know, not as kind of, you know, there is no kind of magic of the movies in this really.
Yeah. I suppose very quickly before we go to the scores, it does have this double relevance. Not only is it looking back at this era, but Sensor and Prano Bailey Bond, to a certain extent also Nivalgar as the lead, they're at the forefront of this slightly sort of created by the industry new wave of horror, you know, female-driven horror films and filmmakers. Are we excited to see what Prano Bailey Bond comes up with next, Hannah?
Absolutely. I can't wait. I think she's a phenomenally talented filmmaker, and absolutely lovely human being as well. I interviewed her for the last issue. Again, I'd recommend people go and read that if they can get their hands on a copy, because she's so kind of generous with her answers and very kind of forthcoming, and just she just loves horror and loves filmmaking so much. And I think that really kind of comes across. If you get the chance, any of our listeners, I know she's doing some Q&As at the moment for the film. I definitely recommend kind of popping along. So I definitely hope she has a long and varied career ahead of her.
I also want to say very quickly that I'm a massive fan of Nee Malgar. She was incredible in that film Calm with Horses. And she was in The Virtues as well, the Shane Meadows thing. And it was kind of clear that she was going to, you know, do lots of good things. And I haven't seen a bad performance by her. And every time I kind of see her, I just think, you know, she's going to be like, you know, the next kind of big in Hollywood thing. You know, I'm kind of, you're kind of waiting for that moment before she's like, when are Marvel going to come calling if they haven't already, you know, like. But she's a phenomenal actress. Mm-hmm. Actor, sorry.
I'd also shout out Prana Paley-Bond's short films that she made before this, because she has been around for a while in music videos and shorts. The one Shortcut that she made with Film 4 and Channel 4 a few years ago is just a very short, very creepy film that ends with just one of the best sort of prosthetic effects of, you know, gory prosthetic effects I've ever seen. It was such a treat seeing that in the cinema and seeing people respond to it. But do seek that out, listeners. Now let's put some scores on this. David, I'll come to you first for In Anticipation, Enjoyment in Retrospect.
Yeah, I'd probably say a four for anticipation, just because this idea of, like, I mean, I grew up really wanting to kind of, like, I grew up in the kind of, like, seeing Evil Dead and Clockwork Orange on, like, pirate films from Camden Market. So, like, you know, there was still a sort of vapors of it around. So, yeah, I was really excited to see it. And, like, you know, all of, like, Mark Kermode's talk about, you know, he's big into kind of censorship, BBFC and that kind of stuff. And, like, yeah, again, kind of in my teens, heard it talked about a lot, so it's interesting to enter into this world. And yeah, like four for enjoyment and in retrospect, yeah, it's kind of very well made, well done film in the moment. And then I think that it's kind of it kind of, there's a sort of sleight of hand in terms of what it's about and what it's trying to do, and it's quite actually, you know, which is I think quite rare for horror films, quite emotional. Like, it's quite sort of, you know, quite sad even. It's kind of, yeah, emo horror or something. But yeah, I like that. I it kind of left an impression.
The coining of a new genre right here. We've had elevated horror, we've had dance horror, folk horror. Next, we need to have that think piece on emo horror. Hannah, what scores would you give this?
Yeah, I agree with David. It's, I think, fours across the board for me. It's definitely one that's really, like, only kind of stayed at the same level of what would the word be, kind of respect I have for it throughout the year. Usually when I watch things at the beginning of the year, there's that initial, like, you know, you feel so excited because you're watching a new movie, but then as time goes on you might think, oh, actually I was being kind of more effusive than necessarily I should have been. But this is definitely one that I still think is one of the year's best, and I'm really excited to kind of see a new generation of people get into the video nasties and kind of discover the delights and not so delights that kind of lurk within that.
Yeah, I'm happy to co-sign that strong recommendation from us. Force across the board from me. That is Censor. Strong recommendation from the three of us for that film. Do seek it out at the cinema if you have a chance to this weekend. Up next, we have another new release with Nicolas Cage in Pig. Okay, a little bit of setup here about Pig, a very uncommon film, I think. Nicolas Cage stars alongside Alex Wolff in this tasty revenge tale about a reclusive truffle hunter who lives alone in the wilderness and must return to his past in Portland in search of his beloved foraging pig after she is kidnapped. So, before we dive into the review section, we're going to have some Wolf on Pig action. Hannah, you had a chat with Alex Wolf. Remind me, that's the Wolf brother that's in Hereditary, not the one that's in Paper Towns,
etc. Yes. So there's Alex and Nat. Nat is the older brother who was in Paper Towns, and Alex was in Hereditary and Old most recently, and is just the nicest guy. I was so it's usually when you meet actors, there's a little bit of a kind of a worry that they might be a bit, you know, a bit pretentious or a bit sort of guarded, but he was really great to talk to. He's so enthusiastic about his work and about Nicolas Cage, loves Nicolas Cage and the movies. He loves the movies. We were talking about like Liv Ullmann and people, you know, he was so kind of just excited to be around. And I guess that's because he's 23 and hasn't been beaten down by life yet. But, you know, I was thrilled to discover that he's not as sad as he often appears in the movies. He really does kind of play some dark roles, bless him.
Well, let's have a listen to this chat that Hannah had with Alex Wolf.
I guess the best place to start would be right at the beginning. So when did you get the script for the film? When did you kind of hear about it? And what was it about the concept of the film that kind of caught your eye?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It was a dark and stormy night. I was very lucky. I've been someone who's mostly had to really fight for parts to come my way. And this was a very lucky thing that just kind of came in, and Nick was already attached, and the director was already a brilliant guy who had made a documentary with his writing partner that had been on an Oscar shortlist. And I just thought it was such an odd, incredible premise. And then I read it, and it was like one of the best scripts I've ever read. And then and Nick Cage, really, he's been one of the main reasons I'm excited by acting. He continues to excite me and exhilarate me. The idea that he was going to be working alongside anyone but me drove me crazy. So I had to do it. I was like, I've been obsessed with him since I was a kid. And so it was just like this kismet, unbelievably lucky, amazing thing. And I've said this before, and I really mean it, that if I encounter a string of horrible luck or whatever ends up happening in the next 5-10 years, to get to have had this experience up close with one of the true artists of my generation, your generation, every person's generation for the past like 10 generations, Nick Cage, then that will have been something I can really hang my hat on, getting to have this experience with him. So
absolutely,
I just feel really lucky.
He's, I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of his as well. So I kind of, I think a lot of people who aren't film people only see the like Wicker Man style freakouts and they don't really get it. But, you know, for people who like movies.
I think the Wicker Man is amazing. Like, I think that maybe people don't, I think that, you know, occasionally he's made some oddball choices in terms of choosing films that are not in, you know, mainstream appreciated, but it's so random what people like. I love that he just follows his heart. He's a true artist. You know, artists just follow their heart. Like, you think about Dali going and painting rhinoceroses for whatever 10 years straight when people were looking to see more of his paintings and he was just only painting rhinoceros. Like, people go into these they express things artistically and they got to follow that, and if they follow anything else, it's kind of a shallow game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think particularly when you've been in the business as long as someone like Nick has, you know, you've got to kind of do your own thing, march to the beat of your own drum. Otherwise, you know, you do end up in that position where people just kind of, there's so many actors out there and you don't get many like Nick Cage who people will kind of remember. And I could, you know, raps, you know, about Nick Cage all day long. But I should ask, like, do you have any favorite Nicolas Cage performances if you've been kind of obsessed since you were little?
Oh yeah, well, I think the main one I think when I was a kid, but that was my favorite, and the one that I continue to look at if I'm ever about to go do a movie, I go back to going to watch Adaptation and watching how someone can be so enormously different in these two roles in the same movie and be so nuanced and felt. And I mean, I think it's one of my favorite performances of all time. So Adaptation, Leaving Las Vegas, Raising Arizona, Bringing Out the Dead, which is just a very underrated, incredible Martin Scorsese movie where his performance is just so clued in to insomnia and pain and this fun, giddy kind of euphoria that's incredible. Vampire's Kiss is an incredible, out there, great performance. And Pig, I think, is one of my favorites of his performances. I think he's just brilliant. I think, but everyone, like Matchstick Men and Family Man, and they go on and on and on.
I think he brings so much to every role in terms of like versatility. He is, you know, you have something like Mandy and then something, oh, like you say, you know, he's worked with Martin Scorsese, he's worked with Paul Schrader many times. He, for me, like, I watched something like Moonstruck and then I watched something, oh, yeah, you know, like Mandy, like, or Joe, like Pig. And I just, you know, he constantly is, even, you know, even now, bringing out kind of things that we don't expect, things that I we know, kind of feel new and refreshing. How was it just kind of being around him and like learning from him and kind of, because it is basically a two-hander, the film, you know, it is, yeah, the two of you for so much of it, just hanging out.
I know. I mean, he's really one of my best friends in the whole world now, you know, and that doesn't happen very often. We, you know, he had just gone through a very complicated relationship, and so had I, and we connected on a very deep personal level and needed each other to get through that very emotional, very trying time. And I think we both got lucky in that we both needed this movie and we needed those characters because we were in a spot where we couldn't survive without working through this pain that we were going through. And also, I think we really needed a friend. I think we really just had a blast together and laughed a lot. And he's someone that I talk to every few days, you know, I give him a ring because we have the best conversations and he gives me the best advice. And you know, he's someone who is really there for everyone he loves. He's really there for his friends and really there for his family. That's just, that's what you don't see in the press, is what an unbelievable friend he is and what an unbelievably loyal guy he is.
I mean, definitely when I was reading an interview about Pig and he was talking about, I think it was his cats that kind of inspired him to like take the role because he was imagining kind of how he would feel. Yeah. And I myself, I'm a big cat person. I have a cat who I adore. And that for me, probably another reason I love Nick Cage is there are not enough kind of Hollywood icons who just love cats. Yeah. You know, they're all into
cats. What about me?
There you go. Okay. That's two I have for my wall of Hollywood icons who appreciate cats. Like,
you can put up my picture now.
I should bring up the fact that, like, for me, the relationship between Rob and Amir reminds me of the kind of grand tradition of the Hollywood odd couple. So, you know, something like,
oh yeah, totally,
something like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or
absolutely,
yeah, or Joe Buck.
I said it was like Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah, Joe Buck and Ransom. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was wondering if there were any kind of reference points, but it sounds like I've hit the nail on the head there.
Absolutely. And and Rain Man was one that we talked about. You know, I think you hit the nail on the head that this movie is really about, it's a buddy movie. It's a real total buddy movie. And you realize that the pig is another really important character in the movie, but in some ways the pig is this ineffable third dimensional metaphor of us coming together.
Yeah, it turns out the real pig was the friends he made along the way.
Exactly.
Yeah. I should ask you about the pig because, I mean, you only have like one scene with her, but how was she as a scene partner?
It was enough. She is a huge diva. It turns out she passed away, which is really sad, and I didn't know that, and so that's a horrible thing in real life. But I will say that she really liked food and would follow me around because I one time fed her, and I really liked having her around. I liked having her oink, and I liked hearing her grunt around the set, and I liked there's a couple pictures that I have with her that are very sweet.
Oh, I think that, again, like, I mean, I talk about cats being underrated, but I think pigs, again, like, underrated, don't see enough of them. I'm a big fan of Babe, the classic.
Oh my God, Babe is so good. Babe is so good. Now Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, Wilbur, you know, I think this is another pig to add, again, to like the cinema canon of like great pigs.
Agreed. I agree. She's a good one.
I also want to ask about the fact that, I mean, I watched Old a few weeks ago and I saw Hereditary when it came out. Even something like My Friend Dahmer, it feels to me like you keep playing these roles where like your character's like having a bad time. And I just want to check, like, are you going to play a guy who's kind of just having a good time, doesn't have any cause to freak out? Is that on the cards for you?
Eh, that's boring. That's my response. That's boring.
Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, I think we all get a lot of catharsis.
You know, I gravitate towards more, you know, interesting characters who are multifaceted. I think there's a lot of scenes in I think My Friend Dahmer in particular is maybe a dark movie, but my character is kind of gliding on a high of fun. I think my character is always giggling and always, you know, so that's one where he's having a good time. It just sort of has a bad result. It's sort of got a bad effect. And then, you know, I always want to play different. I get very worried about any type of pigeonholing. I think that my favorite actors, a lot of my favorite actors worked through some of their demons through their work, like Nick or like Robert De Niro or Al Pacino or Jack Nicholson. And I felt that I think a lot of the performances I responded to were ones where they were working through things kind of in a raw way, especially like maybe like Liv Ullmann or like these Bergman performances, or even like Rashomon, or some of these performances where it feels like these things are coming out of them in a beastly animalistic way. And so I think there's part of me that's always wanting to get out my demons through my work so I can exist in a normal way in my life. But yeah, I'm all about having a good time too. I'm a pretty gregarious, funny guy. So, you know, hopefully that'll happen.
Because I know that you made your first feature in 2019, and I gather from what I read, you're gearing up to do another one next year or later this year.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, how do you think that being on that side of things, you know, kind of working directly on a film yourself, has influenced the way you are as an actor on set? Do you think it's kind of given you an insight into that process you maybe didn't have before?
Yeah, it probably has. I don't know exactly how, but I think it probably has. It's given me some patience or some awareness of some of the challenges maybe I didn't realize before. But it's also given me a bit of a knowledge that, oh, sets can be run in this sort of way that I would like them to run. You know, sometimes I've wondered, well, oh, maybe, you know, actors can't be treated like what they're doing is really special and really hard. You know, maybe that's just not in the cards. And I think when I made my movie, I think the actors felt really like they had the time, even though we didn't have time money-wise, but we had time in terms of, that's where I put my time, is making sure the actress had a chance to explore and play around and improvise. And I think I realized, oh, that can happen, but some other things are sacrificed. And so maybe it gave me some good perspective, but mostly I just love movies so much. You know, that's, I watch like probably two movies a day. And when I'm sick, even more, it's like three or four back to back. So I guess I love them so much that it gave me another window into more of the love that I have for them, and only kind of increased my love for them.
Absolutely. I think you want to get as close to it as possible. I mean, even as a critic, I would love to make a movie one day. You know, I think it's only natural when you love movies that's something you want to kind of do.
You're going to make a movie?
I hope so.
Hey, you gotta. Directed by Hannah Strong.
It's a good name for that. You know, you've got to have a good name. Hollywood's about that.
I love that.
I've been told to ask my final question. So I guess, in the spirit of Pig, and because you're sick, and I guess it's as good a time as any to ask, do you have any kind of comfort dishes that you go to whenever you need a kind of emotional pick-me-up?
Oh, great question. Matzo ball soup with chicken
classic.
Noodle.
Oh.
That's a good one. Ooh, I like that one a lot. You know what I also do when I'm sick? I like to have sushi with tons of wasabi, and that helps a lot.
Clear out the sinuses. Yeah, that's a thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I love that. Love that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much
for your time. And good luck. Go make a movie. Go write a movie and do it.
Thank you.
That the only way to do it is just, you know, write and just to do it.
Well, thank you to Alex Wolf for joining us to speak about Pig. Hannah, let's introduce everyone to this pig. That synopsis sounds like a John Wick movie. Is this Nicolas Cage's John Wick?
Yeah, when I saw the kind of log line, because I think this played... maybe at a festival in the States, I'm not sure, but it definitely, there was a buzz around this. And I think before it came out, everyone was like, oh, it's going to be John Wick with a pig. It's going to be Taken with a pig, which I coined the phrase bacon. okay. Thank you, because I said this to Sophie Monks Kaufman and Mark Ash, and I proceeded to laugh at my own joke. And they were more charmed at me laughing at the joke than they were the actual joke. That I was very proud of. But yeah, so you think that going in. And then I had already seen a few reactions from the States that were like extremely positive, and people saying, oh my God, Pig is one of the best films of the year. So it was, and these were from people I trust. They weren't the kind of usually, you know, the Disney hype machines and the Marvel kind of cheerleaders. It was people I really respect. So I was really up for it, really like figured I would have a good time with it. Oh my God. when I saw this film, it hit me like a freight train. I was just somehow unprepared for the emotional toil and the kind of how beautiful this film is. It's not at all John Wick. It is an incredibly heartfelt story about a man working through grief and trying desperately to hold on to the one kind of good thing in his life. And, you know, kind of ultimately realizing that that's not always possible. I was very, very taken with it. I suppose I should maybe explain to the listeners a little bit more about it. Basically, what we see in the film is Nicolas Cage playing this grizzled, you know, strong, silent type who every so often meets up with Alex Wolff's sort of young buck, truffle dealer, truffle seller, truffle merchant. So he buys the truffles from Nicolas Cage and takes them into the city to sell to the chefs. Portland has a huge kind of fine dining scene. So, you know, that's all well and good. But then one night, Nicolas Cage's beloved pig is kidnapped and they have to kind of work together to find the pig. And this takes them on this really sort of dark journey through Nicolas Cage's past, and it goes to some, you know, some dark places, and I just wasn't really prepared to have this kind of very poetic film about grief and love and family, like, you know, kind of set out in front of me. I felt very seen and very confronted, and yeah, I really can't sing its praises enough. This is a debut as well, which is crazy to me. It's such an impressive film to make on your kind of first go around. Everything from kind of not only the performances, which I think are leagues ahead of most of the things I've seen this year, but, you know, I want to give a big shout out to the score as well, because I've been listening to that nonstop. I think it's just so beautiful and ethereal, and it makes you feel like you are in a forest hunting for truffles with your beloved pig. But yeah, I will have to pass it to David, because I could just sit here saying how good it is all day long.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? There are the moments throughout the film that can cut together into a trailer that does work in the John Wick mold. Nicolas Cage coming out of the woods, going back into a life that he'd previously abandoned in sort of mysterious circumstances, going around to telling people, "I just want my pig back," etc. And it does similarly in this John Wick way build this very rich, detailed world that seems to have existed for so long and has such history to it, as he hooks up with all these people from his past. But the twist being, it's not this high GQ fashion assassin world that John Wick is. It's just the foodie culture of Portland, Oregon. It's such a soulful foodie movie at the end of the day as well. But David, tell us what you made of Pig, and particularly let's talk about what Nicolas Cage is doing here, because of course, is he going full Cage rage or not?
Well, no, I mean, that was very, very pleasant to see, actually. Was like, I think with Nicolas Cage, certainly in the you know, it's hard to sort of dial back to the point when Nick Cage sort of jumped the shark in terms of, like, you know, his presence in a film being a kind of bankable thing in terms of quality. But I'm not sure I can pinpoint it myself, but like, certainly the new millennium hasn't offered as many Cage gems. I mean, the ratio of Cage duds to gems is, you know, tragically on the way to the dud side. So like, I think it's all to do with his castles and his taxes and everything that he needed some. I'm making the money sign on the video chat here, but like, this feels like old school Cage. That's something that he's kind of, you know, really maybe like the first film since like Adaptation where I felt that he's kind of invested in the material to this, like, to a very, very, you know, deep level. and you know, really, really understands the character and is not kind of like just there for, you know, to do his thing. He's really great in the film, and like it's, I think that the thing that is kind of interesting about it is like there is actually sort of some dynamics there. Like, it's not all kind of like, you know, 1,000-yard stares, banging tables, grabbing people by lapels, screaming, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's actually like there are bits of that, but those bits are so much more dramatic because there is this kind of placid, tranquil side to him as well that's quite kind of world weary. And and I think the film, like, you know, as it unfolds, you kind of like, you're sort of learning why he's like that. It's not just a case of like, oh, he's just like that because he's Nick Cage, you know. It's like there is this kind of set of reasons for why he is kind of like he is. I think Pig is definitely one of those films that, like, you know, we talk about, oh, it's not John Wick, but it's this, and it's something else. It's really, yeah. I mean, it's definitely one of those films that you don't really like. I purposely didn't read about it, having seen a lot of people saying go into this as blind as possible, because, like, you know, the way that it kind of goes against expectations is actually the most interesting thing about it. And, you know, it's not, I think it's not like, oh, you think it's John Wick, but it's actually like, you know, time travel lost in space. You know, it's not like some kind of, you know, it's in many ways, it's a kind of smaller and more intimate film than it kind of blends into, but it's still, I think, still like, it's unexpected in an unexpected way. So yeah, that definitely has it going for it. And I think the thing that I liked about it as well is I would say the score. It was more that I liked the fact that it wasn't a synth score. You kind of watch a film like this and you think, okay, here we go, we're gonna have some like moody synths in the background and blah blah blah. But actually, it's this kind of like, you know, it's got a feel of that, the sort of Neil Young Dead Man score, kind of slightly kind of clanging guitars and like twangs, and that organic vibe to the score really kind of fits in with things. But yeah, the thing I really liked about it is the writing, and just how kind of, you know, it felt very complete. Like, it felt like everything, every kind of small detail had been thought through, and it's kind of a 90-minute film where every little sort of bit interlocks in a very sort of satisfying way. And you're kind of left, I don't think it's entire, like, completely, there's some little bits that I didn't think quite work, and some sort of slight leaps between he does this for this reason that I just was like, I'm not quite sure about that. But otherwise it feels like a very kind of tight film. It's in a way very 90s film. Like, I mean, if Sensor is an 80s film, this feels like a 90s film. It feels like the sort of, in, like, you know, kind of biggish indie film that would have maybe gone under a certain amount of scrutiny at a studio to sort of actually get to that green light point that I think you don't really have now, because, you know, that I think that the content and product is the sort of name of the game. So, like, there are chances that a film like this, you know, a half-baked version of this film would, you know, not have worked so well and would have still been green lit. But it's good that there's actually, you know, the script has gone through like phases, and yeah, it feels like a complete film, which is, I know, I don't want to damn it with faint praise, but
Hannah, what scores are we giving Pig?
Definitely a 4 in anticipation, because I'd heard so much kind of effusive chat out of the US. Then a 4 in enjoyment. I think it would have been a 5, but I just was crying for quite a lot of this film, so I can't really, like, you know, I'd have to, I think I am planning on watching it again actually next week at the cinema. And then in retrospect, I think I'm going to have to give it a 5, because I've recommended it to so many people in the past few weeks, and every single person I've recommended it to has come back and said, oh my God, Pig. And I'm like, I know. So there's that joy of kind of being able to share it with other people. But also, I just think it's, you know, there's so many things that I love about it. You know, the performances, the score, the food in it. It made me so hungry as well. We didn't even get into the kind of these beautiful shots of like mushroom tart and like fresh bread and things, and the kind of messages at the core about not only about grief, as I've already mentioned, but there's a really beautiful scene where Robin, Nicolas Cage's character, is in a restaurant, like a fine dining kind of at cuisine restaurant, and he talks to the chef and gives this like blistering takedown, and it is just like chef's kiss. It is just, you know, it's magnificent. So yeah, 4-4-5 for me.
David,
I'd probably say like 3-4-4. Even with the kind of like, it's a good Nick Cage film. I think the bar was set so low that I think even then my kind of expectations were kind of muted. But then, you know, it did definitely outweigh my expectations. Feels like this could be like, you know, who knows what's going to happen in this kind of weird time, but like it's the kind of film that you would imagine would be like a sleeper hit, like in the, you know, if things had been normal, it would have just, you know, the word of mouth would have been amazing, and it would have been this like slow burn over a few months, just slowly getting more money, keeping playing in cinemas, keeping its screens going the distance. And you kind of hope that it, I mean, you know, it's been out in America. I'm not sure how well it's done there, but, you know, it's coming out here. And, you know, I almost feel that like Nick Cage could be a sort of like Oscar, you know, this could be a kind of Oscar comeback for him. It's a very like Oscar-y performance in a way. Maybe that's a conversation for another time, but
yeah, wow.
I don't like to be like, oh, it's Oscar worthy, but you know, this for such a kind of weird small film, you think, well, maybe it could actually kind of transcend its roots in that way.
Well, listeners, there you have it. Two very strong new releases this week. Maybe you'll want to watch Pig as part of a triple bill alongside Gunda and the Truffle Hunters. There's a think piece coming your way, I'm sure, from somebody about the rise of pig-related cinema in 2021. But amazing. What a wonderful week. Two very strong debuts that you know, alive to the future of potential of cinema, but also so aware of the history as well. But speaking of film history, up next is Film Club, and we're going back to one of the original Video Nasties for Possession. Now, I've been given the back cover blurb of the, I think, DVD or Blu-ray release of Possession, so I'm going to read this verbatim. A spiral staircase movie, a never-ending metaphysical game of cat and mouse, a moral aspiration to the heavens, a spotlight on God, a scornful detective movie, a horror movie and frightful, high-octane Baroque work. Possession is all of that at once. It is a film that provokes, but it provokes intelligence above all, not just the merry continuation of our little social mechanisms. Possession is a visionary, scathing attack on what could be called an alien from within. It is a movie that deliberately goes against the new dominant ideology and takes huge risks. This deep-cutting, biological cinema delves into the guts to reach the soul. Through its fire, it revives something that a lot of contemporary movies have lost: emotion, and the prospect of the audience reacting, perhaps even throwing up, figuratively, in brackets, question mark, in front of a screen displaying their own fantasies. Wow, that copywriter went full tilt on Possession.
and what a perfect summary of the film, in a way.
What more can we say, David, about Possession?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a film that I'd discovered from there's this website called Slant Magazine, which has been going for a long time now. It's like most of this century, I think. And they ran a thing in, I think, 2003, 2004, and it was their 100 greatest films. And I remember seeing that list, and it was kind of like alternative films. It wasn't the kind of traditional canon. And Possession was on this list of 100 greatest films. I was like, never heard of it. And it kind of became one of those, like, you know, keep it on a bit of paper in my wallet, and if I ever see it, I'll try and watch it. And eventually it came out, like, it was really hard to come by, and eventually, like, about 5 years later, it came out on DVD. And I was just completely blown away. Like, I just agog at this film. Like, it's just, I've seen it about four times, and it's every time it just sort of completely rattles my mind. So it's by this Polish director Andrzej Zalewski. He's kind of known for his kind of stuff. This is very indicative of his style. I've seen about sort of five or six of his films, and they're like, it's as if like every shot is like done from with the camera mounted on a kind of dirt bike, driving around a room, or driving down a street, or with someone screaming at you. It's like, it's proper kind of high octane, high energy cinema. Everything is done like full tilt. His first film, I guess it's quite apt to mention that his first film is called Mother Joan of Angels, and it's basically considered to be like a kind of European version of The Exorcist. It's kind of nuns being possessed by the devil. It's kind of the devil's The Exorcist. And in a way, this too feels very kind of Exorcist-y, but a far more kind of symbolic and experimental version of the Exorcist. My last kind of contextual point on this is that when it first came out, it was basically, I mean, it got embroiled in this whole video nasties thing, which when you see it is like the most absurd thing ever, and I think it's probably the film that shines the worst light on sort of film censorship, because, you know, it is a kind of deep experimental art house film that has been completely misappropriated. And when it came out, I think it was sort of pigeonholed as this like erotic thriller. It was meant to be like soft porn, and you know, if you've seen the film, it's like definitely not that.
It's the least erotic thing.
Exactly. but you know, like, I guess it is about sex in a way, but like it's not erotic. far from it. But like, yeah, I guess it kind of got lumped in with all these very different films, and like the cover art of the DVD, and I think the original poster is a kind of like Isabella Gianni being kind of ravished by this tentacle monster, which is kind of like the central motif of the film. But yeah, it's just this mind-blowing film about divorce that's like, it's like Bergman video nasty.
Absolutely. It really is. And I did wonder, rewatching it, how much the Luca Guadagnino remake of Suspiria was actually lifting from this film rather than the Argento original, because it's set in divided Berlin, has all of that tentacly weirdness and the sexually charged erotic stuff as well. I wonder how much that was actually maybe a backdoor remake for him. But I had a similar experience to you, David, where I remember when that DVD came out in the mid late 2000s, I think I got it from, you know, Love Film or whatever DVD rental service I was on back then, and it was a complete bolt from the blue, mystifying, provocative, terrifying movie. I think in the sort of decade or so since then, it's become a bit memed. And certainly some sequences with Isabella Gianni when she's in the full throes of an episode of a reverie. There are two sequences particularly where she's wearing sunglasses, looking absolutely fabulous, whilst also screaming into the camera with a mouthful of blood, that has become quite memed. And another one where she's having an episode in a subway where she's writhing and screaming back and forth for what feels like hours, but it's like a maybe 5 or 6 minute scene, and ends just in a pool of sort of sick and blood and pus at the end. Both of those have been kind of, because of the high energy, provocative, you know, almost you could almost say camp nature of it, just how full on it is. That's been perfect for the Tumblr letterboxed crowd to point to a film that goes there. But Hannah, what's your experience of Possession? Was this the first view? Did you know much about it beforehand, or had you watched it before?
Yeah, I watched it before, maybe 2 years ago. I can't remember why. It was definitely something to do with Little White Lies. I watched it then and really liked it. Was definitely not as kind of disturbed by it the first time as I was this time around. I don't know if I was paying less attention the first time, but I had to keep turning the volume down on my laptop because I was watching it last night about midnight and she really does scream. And I was like, my housemates are going to think I'm butchering someone in here. So as I'm sure I've mentioned on this podcast before, I used to live in Berlin and I feel this immediate affinity for whenever I watch a film that's set in Berlin or filmed in Berlin. So I obviously kind of remembered the subway scene and kind of, even though, you know, she's going through this really hard time, I'm sat there going, oh, I really miss the Berlin U-Bahn. It's a really efficient mode of transport. And it's if you ever go to Berlin, it's Gleisdreieck U-Bahn. I would highly recommend you go and kind of look at it because it's, you know, it is still there, still worth a trip.
I've been. But yeah. Last time I went to Berlin, I went to Gleisdreieck station with some shopping. And screamed while my wife stood on looking at me going, what the hell are you doing? As I'm sure many people have done.
It is, I mean, to be fair, like, yeah, there is sometimes that sensation going through those tunnels in Berlin. You do feel like just having a bit of a freak out. But the kind of the long arms of this film, the kind of ways it has like influenced pop culture, I think a lot about, there was a advertisement for, I think, Kenzo that Spike Jonze directed with Margaret Qualley, and it was set to the song Mutant Brain, I think, by I want to say like Chemical Brothers, it might not be Chemical Brothers, but one of those types, one of those like deep electro kind of like freaky bands, and she's doing this like dance that's exactly like the dance in Possession. And I can't remember if he ever admitted that it's basically a direct rip-off, like a high-fashion version of Possession. But
there's also the Gaspar Noé one as well in Climax, where it's like copied quite literally.
Of course. People love like sexy but deeply unsexy possessed dance routines. And what we've already mentioned as well about Luca Guadagnino. I think it is, even if you haven't seen the film, you've probably come across something that has been kind of influenced by or something that has stolen from Possession. And above all, the thing that got me this time watching it is that it's a deeply upsetting film about the breakdown of a marriage. The first, I'd say maybe the first third of it is just about this couple who are going through a very acrimonious divorce, kind of like fighting with each other, and Sam Neill plays this, how would you describe him? He's the husband who's kind of you want to kind of sympathize with him because his wife's gone off the deep end and keeps leaving their young son Bob alone in the house on his own, and he comes home and he's covered in jam and things like that, but then he's incredibly violent towards his wife at the same time and deeply unpleasant, and very hard to reconcile that with like the lovely Sam Neill now, who just like posts on Twitter about his ducks and his sheep and his cows. But yeah, I think it's up there with like, as David said, like scenes from a marriage, in terms of like really visceral depictions of the breakdown of a relationship. If you take out all the tentacle stuff, it is just a relationship drama.
And yeah, one deeply informed, I believe, by Salavsky's own divorce that was happening around the same time. And it is one of those films which just feels so fully felt. Even if it's its most non-narrative moments, you do get this very strong impression of the emotion behind it. I do find it really fascinating going back and watching this. And, you know, we have such a strong image of who Sam Neill is now. But of course, in the early 80s, he had that sort of sinister James Mason energy, and he hadn't fully grown into his face or his physicality. It's almost like, because he wears like a a sort of a suit and a skinny tie throughout it. It's almost like Ian Curtis or Bernard Sumner from Joy Division had wandered into a film at times. But what a film to go and watch. And listeners, if you do go and watch Possession, let us know what you think, because it's something that is so provocative and people have very strong reactions to. I actually rewatched this. I was made fun of off mic for this, but I rewatched this on the commute from Sussex into London that I made yesterday. So on the Thames Link train, I had my laptop watching Possession. But I will say, I watched that knowing that the first 40 odd minutes are relatively straightforward before the Isabella Gianni starts cutting her neck with a turkey electric turkey knife or whatever it is. So. It's probably not one to watch on public transport. Very quickly before we wrap up, Hannah, David, any very inappropriate films you've watched in very public settings?
Yeah, I watch. I'm kind of do this accidentally all the time. There's definitely one I remember watching on a train, but I can't remember what it was. But there was a small child next to me, and I turned like halfway. I was like, I can't do this with a child sat next to me. It's just I feel dirty as a human being. The worst one was Eastern Promises, which I watched on a flight back from, I think, from Toronto Film Festival, and just not an appropriate film to be watching on an airplane. Great movie, not appropriate for public consumption.
David?
Yeah, I had a weird experience where I was on a train, I think to like Manchester or Liverpool, and I was sat next to a nun. And like in the full nun garb, I decided to watch on my laptop this, like, it's a kind of 1930s Japanese film by a director called Hiroshi Shimizu. I can't remember what the film was called now, but like the first, you know, I thought, well, that's innocent enough, you know, and then the first sort of like 20 minutes of the film is like this group of young boys playing outside and frolicking in nature, and there's this long section where they go swimming in a lake and they're all naked, and I was watching this like 30s Japanese films with these naked Japanese boys I flipped my laptop lid and thought, you know, that's not appropriate, really, for a train or next to a nun. So
certainly not for nuns.
No.
You could try Benedetta when that comes.
Yes.
Out.
Okay. Yeah. That might work.
Okay, listeners. Well, also let us know if you have any of those experiences. Weirdly, films are made to be watched in public, but of course, at that point, you've probably bought a ticket to watch it. But not, so you shouldn't be watching them unexpectedly in public. Maybe let us know about the least appropriate films you've watched in public at the usual channels at LWLies on Twitter or via email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. Hannah, David, thank you so much for joining me this week. It's been such a fun time talking through these films. What a strong week for new releases. Let's see if next week is just as strong. We have the remake of Candyman. We have Sean Durkin's latest The Nest. And for Film Club, because it's Sean Durkin's new film, we're going back to his debut, Martha Marcy May, Marlene. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod. And if your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love you to leave one for us. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too.
Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.